The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 4 of Discover Extra Edition contains 5 stories from the July, August, and October 2017 issues of Discover, covering pregnancy, eels, alien contact, surviving space, and yeast. Pregnancy interrupted. A new device can replicate the placenta, bringing hope for babies born premature. Picture rows of translucent tanks in a dark room. Partially formed embryos float silently, bathed in amniotic fluid. That's the science fiction portrayal of an artificial womb, where machines gestate our babies, stirring unsettling undertones of inhumanity. It's birth without pregnancy. As the Matrix's Neo might say, whoa. While that's still the stuff of fantasy, there have been serious attempts to create artificial wombs dating back to the 1960s. Most fell far short of the warm embrace of a real placenta. Scientists keep trying, partly because pregnancy is so complex, and, like anything else human, childbirth can go wrong, with consequences that affect a child's entire life. Premature births occur in more than 10% of pregnancies and can result in heightened risks for lung diseases, cerebral palsy, and developmental disorders. For extremely premature babies, those born before 28 weeks of pregnancy, the statistics are grim. 30 to 50% die, and up to half of those who survive experience some sort of health issue. The best we can do for preemies today is place them in a heated, humid incubator and pump in nutrients through IVs and tubes. Though we may not feel comfortable abdicating procreation just yet, humanity could clearly use some help. The earliest attempts at fake wombs failed to sustain animal fetuses for longer than a few days. With improved technology, that marker was pushed back. But animals weaned on such systems still emerged with major birth defects, if they survived at all. The latest step forward comes from researchers at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, who successfully gestated premature lambs in an artificial placenta for a month. The lambs, removed from their mothers at the human equivalent of 22 weeks, developed normally inside the fake womb. They were born nearly indistinguishable from lambs birthed normally. The device, called a biobag, is basically a clear plastic bag filled with an electrolyte fluid. The fetus's own heart pumps blood through an external oxygenator to avoid dangerous pressure differences. The lamb's umbilical cord pulls in nutrients, and external heaters maintain a healthy temperature. The researchers even plan to pipe in recordings of the mother's heartbeat as a soothing soundtrack. The results were published in April in Nature Communications. The biobag addresses a crucial concern for fetuses, lung development. Once a baby's budding lungs are exposed to air, there's no going back, no matter what stage of maturation they may be in. The fluid environment of the fake womb, however, lets lung development continue unhindered. Although the biobag does mark a significant step forward for artificial womb technology, it's not ready for human fetuses yet. For one thing, human babies are smaller, and downsizing the device could bring unforeseen complications. The scientists also have to find the right electrolyte fluid mix and figure out how to connect to human umbilical cords. These problems are surmountable, however, and the researchers say that they expect human trials in 3 to 5 years. Beyond saving preterm infants, The greatest benefit may be lowering life-altering birth defects by letting babies continue growing in a womb. The looming prospect of gestation outside a woman's body has some ethicists raising concerns, such as women being compelled to use the device to shorten pregnancy leaves. Dina Davis, a professor of bioethics at Lehigh University, sees this concern as overwrought. "I don't think anyone's going to force a woman to have a C-section and use this thing," she says. Davis focuses instead on the potential benefits the technology could bring. "I actually think this could be a fabulous thing," she says. "The absolute worst place for a preemie is a neonatal ICU. The units can be bright, noisy, and stressful." Marcus Davey, a BioBag team member and developmental physiologist at CHOP, stresses that the device isn't meant to reinvent pregnancy. He still doesn't think it will work for babies born earlier than 23 weeks, a crucial window for development. And they don't plan on trying. The main goal is to offer an alternate therapy for these infants born at 23 to 25 weeks, he says. The current standard of care is putting them on a ventilator and giving them a high level of oxygen. We've been doing that for 25 years, and mortality and morbidity rates in these infants, it really hasn't shifted. The Vanishing Eels. Scientists reveal new clues about one of nature's most mysterious migrations. Johannes Schmidt spent 25 years chasing an enigmatic fish across the Atlantic Ocean. The Danish biologist surrendered the hunt only after his ship was torn to pieces on a Caribbean coral reef. Schmidt was trying to solve an ancient mystery about one of nature's strangest fish, eels. Aristotle suggested the slithering species emerged spontaneously from the earth. But by the early 1900s, Schmidt and others suspected eels bred in the open ocean instead of their lifelong freshwater homes. Schmidt's early sea expeditions stayed close to shore, casting nets off European coastlines. Then, in 1904, he caught a young eel south of Iceland, implying the fish were indeed spawning at sea. So Schmidt journeyed further into the open ocean. The tinier the eels he found, the closer he figured he was to their spawning grounds. Eventually, he sailed from northern Europe toward the Caribbean, ultimately catching dime-sized eels near the Sargasso Sea. It's an enormous patch of seaweed in the southwest Atlantic Ocean. He guessed this calm stretch of ocean was the eel asylum, the place where European and American eels are born, spawn, and die. It's been nearly a century since Schmidt's hypothesis, but eels still haven't surrendered their secrets. We now know that American eels inhabit streams, lakes, and rivers from Venezuela to Greenland, and the similar, yet genetically distinct, European eels live anywhere from Norway to North Africa. But scientists still haven't seen these eels spawning. So that eel you ate on your sushi roll? No one knows for certain where it was born. In recent years, however, scientists have been closing in. Like Schmidt, they're trying to track eels as they migrate back to the Sargasso Sea. To crack the case, Canadian researchers devised a way to attach satellite tags to the eels to trace their routes during the 1,500-mile swim from shore. Along the rugged coast of Nova Scotia, scientists caught several dozen eels in 2014. They dumped the slithering fish into a water tank in the back of a pickup truck and drove to the little village of Bay St. Lawrence. There, the team attached satellite tracking tags. Picture several feet of eel dragging a huge fishing lure, and put the fish back into the Atlantic. They'd tried a similar feat the two previous years, releasing the squirming fish from a nearby estuary, but sharks ate all the eels before they reached the open ocean. Just 8 of the 38 eels released over the course of the 3-year experiment even made it to the ocean. Biologist Melanie Berger-Pon of Quebec's Laval University says tracking the eels is hard because the tags are cumbersome for the eels. They're also expensive, so scientists can only buy so many. One eel from the 2014 tracking attempt did make the team's efforts worthwhile. Eel number 28 swam from Nova Scotia and reached the far northern limit of the suspected Sargasso Sea spawning site. A first. But that's where number 28's tag popped up to the surface, as designed, leaving the team to guess at its fate. We don't know what happened to the eel and why it went much farther than the others, Burger Pond says. We just hope that eel number 28, as the other tagged eels, all made it to the spawning area in the Sargasso Sea. Number 28 also taught Burger Pond's team about its migration route. The fish commuted in two phases. First, it swam north along the continental shelf in shallow waters about 100 miles from the Canadian coast. Then, it made a beeline south for the Sargasso, vanishing east of Bermuda and confirming Schmidt's theories nearly a century later. And late last year, a large group of European scientists published their results of tracking eels from that continent. They tagged some 700 eels, but only 87 made it from coastal waters into the open ocean. Then, predators ate most of the fish not long after they left the coast. None made it to the Sargasso. How they get there is not known, says behavioral ecologist David Wrighton of the Center for Environment, Fisheries, and Aquaculture Science, or why the journey has become so long over evolutionary time. Other adult fish, like salmon, live their lives at sea and return to the rivers and streams of their birth to spawn. Eels do the opposite. They're born in the Sargasso, and then ocean-spanning currents carry them to their home waterways, whether that's in Maine or Maryland. That ride determines where they end up. But on their return trip, eels aren't heading for some set location. The Sargasso Sea's boundaries shift because it's surrounded by ocean currents. It's the only sea not bounded by land. So, how do adult eels know where to go? Navigation is likely helped by a number of cues and clues, like odor, magnetism, and other oceanographic features, says Wrighton, the lead author on the 2016 European study published in Science Advances. Recent genetic studies are also uncovering clues about eels' hidden spawning. Lab studies reveal that European and American eels each belong to a single population. So an eel that lives in a Norwegian fjord is no more cold-adapted than one living in the Mediterranean. It implies that these eels, like their kin in other oceans, breed in massive orgies, with European eels mating somewhere east of American eels. Scientists call it panmixia. It takes place deep in the water column, not on the surface, says ecologist José Martín Pólar of Denmark's Aarhus University. That's why no one has seen it. To picture this spawning, imagine swarms of eels writhing about in the dark. The males cast their sperm into the water. The females are fertilized at random, no natural selection during breeding, and then lay millions of eggs. Afterwards, all the adults likely die. The little orphan eels then venture back to their species' coast. These are tiny little creatures, and they do not swim that well, says oceanographer Irina Ripina with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Her team modeled how eel larvae traverse the Atlantic and found that the tiny fish must swim their way toward currents, which help them along to far-off shores. Earlier this spring, an American-led team of scientists explained how that happens in the journal Current Biology. The team let young eels swim around a contraption that mimicked the magnetic fields found along the animal's migratory path. Rather than guiding the little swimmers toward land, the researchers found infant eels have a map sense that steers them toward the Gulf Stream, which offers an easier ride toward Europe. Another team, which published results in Science Advances in June, tested even younger eels in a Norwegian fjord and found similar magnetic navigation capabilities. Scientists hope that unraveling the eel's secrets will help recovery efforts. Baby eels, called elvers, now face a major obstacle to survival. Elver fishing is booming in Maine and along the East Coast. The Japanese have obsessed over unagi no kabayaki, a type of grilled eel, since ancient times. So, as global fisheries have banned the capture of eels to protect populations, Japan did so after the 2011 tsunami. Consumers have turned to American eels. European eels are also critically endangered. American fishermen can now net thousands of dollars per pound for the live, squirming elvers. Once caught and sold, they're shipped to farms in China and Japan, where they're raised to adulthood and sold globally for sushi. That makes understanding the natural migratory path crucial to preserving the species. For instance, knowing that eels in Spain and Sweden are no different could add geographic flexibility to reintroduction efforts. And a better understanding of how eels reproduce might one day let people farm eels from birth, something that's currently impossible. But until cameras catch eels spawning in the Sargasso Sea, scientists can't fully claim they've put Aristotle's mystery to rest. Everything worth knowing about alien contact. Hey, it could happen. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, has been going on for more than 50 years, with ever more sophisticated detection systems and creative ideas about how ET might come calling. Astronomers haven't heard anything yet, but perhaps it's only a matter of time. Check out what they've been looking for, how they would know if they found it, and what the aftermath might be. How to listen. The universe emits many signals of its own. Black holes send out bursts of radio waves, X-rays, and gamma rays. The dusty disks of forming planetary systems shine in infrared waves. Scientists must separate those so-called dumb signals from the smart signals that might come from extraterrestrials. Because of that necessary sifting, they assume that aliens would try to make their messages look different from the natural pings of the universe. In general, astronomers look for two hallmarks of technology. First, frequency compression. Narrow-band signals come in on a small range of frequencies, like an individual radio station. Broadband signals spread across a wider range, like a broadcast that contains the whole FM band at once. Natural objects can only make signals so skinny, so if scientists see one that covers a tiny range of frequencies, like a laser or a satellite ping, they know it had to come from technology. And second, time compression. Scientists look for signals that last only for a flash and then repeat, perhaps in a pattern that looks purposeful. Bonus, almost but not quite natural looking. Astronomers also keep their telescopes' eyes out for anything that looks nearly natural. When researchers discovered fast radio bursts, super quick bursts that release at least as much energy in milliseconds as the sun does in a month, they threw around aliens as a dim possible explanation. And when astronomers discovered a star in 2015 whose light seems to occasionally get blocked by something big, one researcher proposed it was an alien megastructure. We still aren't sure what causes either phenomenon, but scientists are studying them as natural emissions from the universe. Are we there yet? You wouldn't dip a glass in the ocean, come up with no fish inside, and conclude no fish exist. Astronomer Jill Tarter often says that's where humans are with SETI. To fill enough glasses to get a good sense, researchers want to look at 1 million stars within 1,000 light-years of Earth and scan all the frequencies between 1 and 10 gigahertz. When they've done that, maybe they'll have caught a fish or two, or will at least be able to say more about how many swim in the cosmic sea. Here's how close they've gotten proportionally to that goal. 99.959%. That's how much searching astronomers still have to do to cover 1 million stars. 0.041%. That's how much of that search they have completed for all Radio SETI projects. Our best bets. Just as you wouldn't birdwatch in interior Antarctica, you wouldn't search for aliens in inhospitable environments. Astronomers have discovered thousands of planets, but only a few so far meet our basic requirements for possibly hosting life, being rocky and in the habitable zones around their stars, where water can stay liquid. Here are a few potentially life-friendly star systems where astronomers will aim their alien-seeking telescopes. Proxima Centauri. The star system closest to our Sun has a planet, Proxima b, similar to Earth's mass. No one knows if it has any water, but it's just 4 light-years away, so maybe we could find out in person someday. Wolf 1061. The second planet in this star's solar system is the next closest Earthish-sized planet in a habitable zone, after Proxima b. It's just 14 light-years from where you're sitting right now. GJ-667. A mere 22 light-years away, this solar system has 3 super-Earth planets, between Earth's and Uranus's mass, in the habitable zone. And in the hunt for extraterrestrial life, every possibility counts. TRAPPIST-1. Some 39 light-years away, this sun has 3 potentially rocky planets in its habitable zone, and, bonus, 4 additional rocky planets. That's 7 Earthish-sized planets in one spot. Kepler-186. About 561 light-years away, the 5th planet discovered in this dwarf star system circles its star's habitable zone. The planet was the first astronomers found with a size similar to Earth. Searches past and present. 1960, astronomer Frank Drake performs the first modern SETI experiment, called Project Ozma, after a Wizard of Oz character. With an 85-foot radio telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, he looks at 2 sun-like stars for signs of alien technology. 1961, a small SETI conference takes place in Green Bank, at which Drake presents what's now called the Drake Equation, which scientists use to estimate how many extraterrestrial civilizations may exist in our galaxy. 1973, Ohio State University undertakes a SETI program with its Big Ear Observatory. 1979, the University of California, Berkeley begins a long-lived project called Serendip, the search for extraterrestrial radio from nearby developed populations, at Hat Creek Observatory in Northern California. 1983. At Harvard University, astronomer Paul Horowitz launches Project Sentinel using an 84-foot radio telescope. 1988. NASA endorses its SETI studies, and scientists begin building the instruments they need to perform a search. 1992. NASA's SETI project, now the High Resolution Microwave Survey, HRMS, turns paperwork and plans into a physical project at Goldstone Observatory in California and the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico. 1993. Just a year after its start, HRMS ends when Congress cancels its funding. 1995. The private SETI Institute raises philanthropic funds and starts its Project Phoenix, a reincarnated version of HRMS. Also 1995, Horowitz continues his SETI work at Harvard with the Billion Channel Extraterrestrial Assay, BETA. 1999, Berkeley launches the citizen science project SETI at Home, which lets your computer, in its downtime, dip into Serendip data. 2005, the SETI Institute begins building a telescope dedicated to searches for aliens. 2015, METI, M-E-T-I, Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence International, begins an optical SETI program at the Boquete Observatory in Panama. And 2016, the $100 million Breakthrough Listen project, sponsored by Russian magnate Yuri Milner, begins a 10-year search that includes both radio and optical strategies. Should we transmit a message? In addition to listening for ET's phone calls, we could also try catching his attention. But scientists aren't sure whether that's a great idea. On the super pro side, here's Douglas Vaycock, President METI, Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence International. One of the assumptions we typically make is that if there are civilizations out there, they will take the initiative in letting us know they're there. But if they do what we're doing, we'll never make contact. I want to send an intentional message letting other civilizations know that we want to engage in the conversation. On the pro side, Seth Shostak, Senior Astronomer, Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. I'm in the pro-transmitting camp, says Shostak. In one position paper, he explains that if an alien society wanted to destroy us, keeping quiet wouldn't keep us hidden anyway. Any putative extraterrestrials who are in possession of technology that would allow them to threaten our world will also be able to detect our unintentional leakage signals. The anti-side, Jill Tarter, former director, Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. We aren't grown up enough to take on 10,000-year projects, and transmitting for a moment or a year makes no sense. Transmission is in our future, assuming we make it to the advanced technological civilization status. And on the super anti-side, Stephen Hawking, physicist and mathematician, University of Cambridge, author of A Brief History of Time. Hawking has warned that broadcasting our existence could end with an unpleasant visit from highly evolved aliens. Such advanced aliens would perhaps become nomads, looking to conquer and colonize whatever planets they can reach, he said in 2010. The history of our own species backs him up. Everything worth knowing about surviving space. Settle the final frontier. Hundreds of humans have orbited Earth since space exploration began more than half a century ago. In that time, astronauts have walked on the moon and even endured more than a year in microgravity. But becoming a multiplanetary species, whether to flee a dying world or just explore the unknown, means learning to live without easy access to Earth's resources and conditions. The first space settlers will face some challenges as old as life itself, while other problems will rear their heads for the first time. Humans must solve them all if we want to survive beyond Earth's warm embrace. Problem number one, astrogrub. While our technology has advanced beyond spears and ceramic jugs, food and water remain an eternal challenge. Astronauts on the International Space Station, ISS, and other nearby outposts can survive on supplies shipped from Earth. But for any human settlement to persist further out, the thin thread of an Earth-based supply chain will prove dangerously fragile. If there's a crop failure on Mars, it occasionally happens in Antarctica's greenhouses, which serve as an analog. Colonists can't live on astronaut ice cream for the 2 years it would take for emergency supplies to arrive. The solution? Mining and greenhouses. The only sustainable answer is to mine and farm the solar system. Water mining on comets and asteroids should be far more cost-effective than heaving tons of H2O out of Earth's gravitational grip. Greenhouses are also cheaper than shipping. Scientists have already grown small test plots aboard the ISS. Russia's orbiting Mir station flourished with plants, from wheat to weeds. And perhaps most intriguing, research suggests that Martian and lunar soil could be used to grow crops like wheat and even potatoes. But just in case those crops fail, Red Planet settlers would want enough in storage to make a doomsday prepper seem ill-prepared. Space colonizers could even adopt a DIY approach to building materials by baking lunar and Martian regolith, rocks and dirt, into ceramics rather than transporting heavy supplies like steel and metal. Problem number two, coming down is hard to do. Floating in space may look fun, but it's also problematic. Humans, plants, and other animals all evolved to survive 1G of force, the average gravity they feel at Earth's surface. The body does less work in zero gravity, and returning to normal gravity strains muscles, hearts, and the whole cardiovascular system. While the Moon and Mars, humanity's next destinations, do have some gravitational pull, the Moon packs about 1/6 Earth's gravity, and Mars boasts roughly 1/3. Scientists think it would be tough to adapt to Earth after living for years on the Red Planet. But what if Martian settlers stay there? And what about space explorers who don't want to touch the ground at all? The solution? Take yourself for a spin. Long-term orbiting astronauts could live in a Stanford torus. The structure, developed by NASA and Stanford University in the 1970s, is a design for a space station, essentially a hollow ring that spins 4 times per minute. Picture 2001, A Space Odyssey. This motion provides artificial gravity by means of centrifugal force, like a sock stuck to the drum of a spinning clothes dryer. Astronauts and cosmonauts have spent over a year in zero gravity with few problems, and those mostly arise when reacclimating to Earth. So it's logical to assume low gravity would be safe, perhaps even pleasant, for short missions. But we have no long-term studies of how humanity would cope with years spent in the gravity of another world. Our best evidence is that between 1969 and 1972, a dozen men walked on the Moon's surface for a few days with no ill effect. Before we discover if we can survive as a species beyond Earth, we should probably take a few more walks out there. Problem number three, off-planet birds and bees. Even if well-prepared adventurers can overcome all these challenges, there is still a civilization-stopping hurdle that science has barely explored. Can we procreate in space? The problems of radiation and low gravity are likely magnified for developing babies and growing children. And exposing babies to radiation and zero G is ethically fraught, so it's also hard to learn more. But before an infant even arrives on the scene, scientists still don't know how important gravity is for successful sex, in a Darwinian sense anyway. Experiments in zero gravity with rats, quail eggs, jellyfish, and wasps have not been promising for fertilization, implantation, or gestation, with different problems arising within each species and at each stage. That's not to say the results are especially damning, though. Many were simply inconclusive. The solution? Let's change the subject. The truth is that more than half a century after first venturing into space, we're still in the dark when it comes to space sex. As far as we know, it's never even happened between humans, though rumors abound. Whether it's because space agencies are more focused on short-term goals or because they're simply prudish, little research has gone into whether humans have any hope of continuing the species off-world. Maybe one day. Problem number four, cosmic storms. Earth's atmosphere and magnetic field protect us from the constant stream of harmful solar radiation and other occasional deadly particles from deep space. Venturing beyond Earth's protection is a gamble, but how dangerous is it? Nuclear accidents and attacks show that short, severe exposure to radiation is deadly for humans. During solar storms, spacefarers hunker in shielded areas of their stations, akin to tornado or bomb shelters. But scientists still don't know how the human body will react to sustained, low-level doses of radiation inherent in space travel. There are few ethical ways to find out. However, an accidental decades-long exposure in Taiwan suggests it's not as simple as more radiation is bad. when 1,700 apartment buildings were unintentionally exposed to radiation from 1983 until 2005, residents actually had lower rates of cancer and birth defects. The solution? Gimme shelter. Scientists still don't have a solution for shielding interplanetary astronauts from radiation. But a space station in equatorial low Earth orbit, ELEO, would sit inside Earth's magnetic field. It would receive most of the benefits of radiation shielding that ground dwellers enjoy. Al Globus, a researcher with San Jose State University and NASA Ames Research Center, has put a lot of thought into such a dwelling. ELEO is the best place for safe radiation by a large margin, he says. For people who want to travel beyond Earth's magnetic field, the only other safe and long-term option might be underground. Hiding some 15 feet under the surface of Mars or the Moon would provide all the radiation shielding of home. Both those worlds also have natural caves. Ancient underground lava flows have carved tube-like caves that can stretch up to 1,000 yards wide and extend for many miles. Occasionally, parts of the cave ceiling can collapse, creating a large skylight opening. By securing these natural skylights with thick glass, the vast interior spaces could be pumped full of air and used as a prefab home. You can imagine setting up a large mirror farm on the surface to bounce light into the tunnel, says Jeff Greeson, CEO of Agile Aero and an aerospace expert. Such a setup would bring sunlight to living or green spaces. Humanity's future could look much like our past in Earth's caves. Everything worth knowing about yeast, a fungus of many trades. Our relationship with yeast is like a college friendship that grew beyond keggers and into distinguished adulthood. We've partied with our eukaryotic wingmen dating back to at least 7,000 BC, using them in foods and head-spinning libations. In 1680, Anton von Leeuwenhoek, godfather of microscopy, gazed upon yeast for the first time. That's when we started moving past the party years. We still throw down with yeast, but we've grown up and have jobs now. These days, the fungus is a laboratory champion, an engine of industry. It underpins Nobel Prize-winning breakthroughs and churns out biofuels and novel medicines. Indeed, yeast may someday save our lives. What is yeast? There are over 1,500 species of yeast. The microscopic, single-celled eukaryotic fungus is found everywhere, and we know it well. Beer barons control its evolution, and scientists fiddle with its DNA. One-third of yeast genes have counterparts in the human genome, many of which are associated with diseases such as cancer. And given that yeast is inexpensive, reproduces quickly, and is easy to work with, it's the most well-studied organism known to humans. Winning Nobel Prizes. Yeast is basically the MVP of lab organisms. It's helped scientists claim 5 Nobel Prizes in the 21st century, 2001, 06, 09, 13, and 16. Yoshinori Osumi, the most recent prize winner, used baker's yeast to identify genes crucial in autophagy, the process by which cells recycle their components. Diseases like Parkinson's, type 2 diabetes, and cancer have been linked to disruption in this cellular recycling process. The autophagy machinery in yeast cells is similar to that in human cells, and Osumi's work, which began in the 1990s, gives scientists new targets for possible treatments. BioSentinel Mission 2018. Planned for launch in July 2018, NASA's BioSentinel spacecraft will expose yeast to the ravages of interplanetary radiation. Cards dotted with a series of microwells housing 3 strains of yeast will be activated via a hydrating injection at different points along an 18-month timeline. scientists will track the yeast's growth and metabolic activity. The experiment will be replicated aboard the International Space Station and on Earth for comparative samples. It'll be the first experiment elucidating the biological effects of radiation beyond low Earth orbit in over 40 years, according to NASA. Pasteur's revenge. Soaked in the vinegar of defeat after the Franco-Prussian War, French chemist and microbiologist Louis Pasteur vowed to avenge his homeland by hitting the Germans where it hurt, the beer. A pioneer of immunization and food sterilization, Pasteur also experimentally proved in the 1850s that yeasts drove the fermentation process, gobbling sugars to produce ethanol, carbon dioxide, and a host of other compounds essential to beer. He identified microbes that could spoil a batch of beer and devised methods to keep them out, preventing contamination and enhancing beer's flavor. By the time the war broke out in 1870, Pasteur, jaded by personal losses, forbade publishing his brewing secrets in German, hoping to give French brewers enough scientific artillery to threaten Germany's chokehold on the industry. Pasteur wanted France to produce the world's finest beer, or what Pasteur dubbed the beer of revenge. His work inspired a generation of beer barons, including J.C. Jacobsen, who founded Carlsberg in Denmark. In the 1880s, scientist Emil Hansen isolated a yeast strain and named it Saccharomyces pasteurianus, in homage to Pasteur, a man who reportedly didn't even like the taste of beer. Gross yeast tricks. Beard beer, from Oregon-based Rogue Ales, is brewed with a strain of wild yeast harvested from 9 beard hairs plucked from brewmaster John Mayer. The Baltimore Sun said the American wild ale has a smooth finish and citrus notes. In 2015, British blogger Zoe Stavry reportedly baked a sourdough leavened with yeast from a vaginal infection. Granted, it was a very small amount. Candida albicans, the typical culprit behind such infections, likely played a role in this baking project. Doctors do not advise repeating this at home. DNA slipping. We've been slipping foreign DNA into yeast since 1978, when Gerald R. Fink at MIT figured out how. In 2015, scientists swapped genes crucial for yeast survival with human versions, and of the 414 genes they tested, nearly 50% of the human proteins could keep the yeast alive. Today, yeasts are programmed to secrete human proteins used in vaccines, insulin, and other biopharmaceuticals. Spider silk. In the lab at Bolt Threads in Emeryville, California, technicians are using yeast enhanced with spider DNA to brew silk proteins that are spun into textiles. Bolt researchers control fabric qualities, like stretch and softness, by manipulating protein chemistries, fermentation conditions, and other aspects of the spinning process. In 2016, the company received $50 million to scale up production, even partnering with apparel company Patagonia to develop designer products. Biofuels. We've used yeast to convert plant cellulose and starch into biofuels like ethanol for decades. However, the process still isn't efficient, and scientists are genetically altering yeast to change that. Yeast doesn't function well in high alcohol concentrations, so upping its resistance is one objective. Also, coaxing yeast to move beyond glucose to sugars found in non-food plant fibers could lower costs. As it stands, 90% of car engines still run on petrol, as opposed to alcohol. that wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.